past few weeks have been something of a public relations nightmare around here. Dallas has become the city that is bringing Ebola to America. Both reasonable and irrational fears are gripping not only our city, but indeed are spreading like a virus across the nation. Presbyterian Hospital, a hospital that many of us trust, a hospital to which many of us have gone for our own medical care, is now being vilified as being variously incompetent, uncaring, negligent, and even mendacious. Closer to home, Highland Park High School has been involved in the news recently, accused of banning books, raising the specter of censorship. And just as that trouble at the high school was settling down, scores of parents at Armstrong Elementary withheld their children from attending class for fear that their children would contract Ebola through contact with the daughter of the county judge, a man who, in my opinion, has courageously reached out to help the family of Thomas Eric Duncan. And so, to borrow from the title of a favorite children's book, it has been a terrible, horrible, no good, very bad couple of weeks here in Dallas. For all of the great things that are going on in our city, we've got image problems. Of course, we're not the only ones. The church has image problems, perhaps especially among young adults. Now, let me be clear, by church, I don't mean specifically Highland Park United Methodist Church. I mean the church broadly speaking. According to Barna polling, 1/4 of 18 to 29-year-olds say church demonizes everything outside church, including the music and movies and technology that define their generation. 1/3 of young adults polled call church boring. About 1/4 say faith is irrelevant and Bible teaching is unclear. 1/5 of those polled say God is absent from their church experience. 3 in 10 young people find church is too exclusive in this pluralistic and diverse multicultural age. Over 1/3 of young people say church is not a safe place to express doubts, even though they have questions they would like to discuss. Frankly, friends, it's hard to invite people to become followers of Jesus when sizable portions of your target audience think that Jesus' followers are boring or irrelevant or out of touch or exclusive and not open to questions. The church brand has image problems. And I raise this issue because we live in a brand-conscious world. As frightening as it may be, studies repeatedly show that children as young as 2 years of age are starting to recognize logos, corporate logos, and request specific brands as soon as they begin to speak. Our children do not merely want a hamburger, they want a McDonald's hamburger. And they want it in the Happy Meal because the Happy Meal doesn't simply have interlocking building bricks, it has Legos. And children can articulate that desire. We adults, of course, only fly Southwest. And we only stay at the Marriott. We only eat at Houston's. We only wear Chanel. And in that sense, we are marked men and women. Our brand preferences say something not only about our tastes, but also about our identity and whose we are, to whom we belong. We are Princeton men or Clintonistas. We are Beliebers or even Lady Gaga's Little Monsters, if that's your style of music. Knowing who we are, that is, knowing our brand, is critical, particularly in relation to Jesus' answer to the question posed by some religious leaders of the day who came to Jesus alongside with some Jewish supporters of the Roman rulers. The question concerned paying taxes to the emperor. It was a trick question, one meant to entrap Jesus into saying something for which they could either make him take an unpopular stand, or in which they could get him arrested and thus off their hands. After a bit of flattery, they come straight to the question, is it lawful to pay taxes to the emperor or not? On the one hand, no one in Jerusalem, this devoutly Jewish city, wanted to pay taxes, period, because paying taxes meant paying for the dubious privilege of being occupied in one's own homeland by an efficient but often brutal Roman Empire. To complicate matters, paying the poll tax meant paying using a Roman coin that bore the emperor's image, which to a devout Jew amounted to idolatry. Moreover, it meant paying with a Roman coin that bore the emperor's title and his claim to be divine, which to a devout Jew was blasphemy. On the other hand, however, if Jesus encouraged non-compliance and non-payment of the tax, there would be hell to pay at the hands of Roman soldiers. Jesus thought about the question for a while and came up with this ingenious answer. Give to the emperor what belongs to the emperor, and give to God what belongs to God. Or, as the old King James Version puts it, render unto Caesar that which is Caesar's, and unto God what is God's. The question, though, is how do we know whose is whose? What belongs to Caesar and what belongs to God? Caesar was always very good at marking his own stuff. Caesar would set up statues of himself throughout the empire. You always knew what belonged to Caesar. And then later, as Caesar changed identities, as we the people became Caesar, that is, as the United States government became Caesar, we continue to mark our stuff, our money, our missiles, even our mercy. You can't go very far in Haiti without seeing packages marked USAID, which are being used in all sorts of very helpful ways. But it isn't just Caesar who's good at marking his stuff. The World Series is brought to you by Home Depot. The post-game show is brought to you by Chevy. Even Sesame Street is brought to you by the letters A and R and the number 6. We wear polo ponies and Izod alligators. We carry handbags monogrammed YSL or LV. Our cars display the emblems of their manufacturers, be it the ever so humble Hyundai or the rather more fabulous Ferrari. We think we are being brand loyal. Maybe we're just being branded, like a bunch of cows who belong to a jealous owner. So again, what belongs to Caesar and what belongs to God? If we can figure that out, then we can give to each what belongs to each. Only God, as often happens, has to fight Caesar for control of the money. We stamp "In God We Trust" on ours, but the money bears the image of George Washington and Abraham Lincoln. The titles on it belong to the Treasurer of the United States and the Secretary of the Treasury. And if it's weapons we're talking about, the whole armor of God just doesn't seem to be a match for the kind of stuff we're deploying against the terrorists these days. I mean, can the belt of truth really outgun a fully loaded ammo belt? Can the breastplate of righteousness provide the same kind of defense as a Kevlar vest? What is the sword of the Spirit when it is up against laser-guided missiles, all of which are stamped U.S. military? Even mercy can be hard to claim for God. The Red Cross and the United Way and Doctors Without Borders have all gotten in on the business of humanitarian relief. To stay competitive, we sometimes have to hide our denominational, to say nothing of our Christian identity. The Methodist Mission Home is now called Providence Place. What used to be St. Paul's Hospital is now St. Paul University Hospital. And what started out as the Young Men's Christian Association later became the YMCA, and now it's known simply as the Y, kind of like the artist formerly known as Prince. In a brand-conscious world that is reluctant to be identified with religion, how do we know what belongs to Caesar and what belongs to God? Psalm 24:1 gives us one answer. It is, in fact, the biblical answer, an easy answer, if you will, for Psalm 24:1 says, "The earth is the Lord's and everything that is in it. It all belongs to God." At the 8:30 service, we present our offerings and pray, "All things come from you, O God, and with gratitude we return to you what is yours." On that view, what little is ours on the installment plan. We're given to be stewards or trustees of what God has given to us. And so if, in fact, it all belongs to God in the first place, then we just need to give it all back to God. Render unto Caesar what is Caesar's and unto God what is God's. But in that sense, if it is all God's in the first place, then the answer becomes a lot harder. For how exactly do you give it all to God and still manage to pay the mortgage or the rent and the student loans and for groceries, to say nothing of Caesar's taxes? Once upon a time, a young man came to Jesus. He was very wealthy, a man of position and prominence, and he asked Jesus how it was he could inherit eternal life. Well, Jesus said, "Love the Lord your God and love your neighbor as yourself." "I've done those things," the man said. "Surely there must be something else." "Oh, indeed there is," Jesus says. "Go and sell all you have and give the proceeds to the poor." And the young man went away very sad because he just didn't see how that would be possible. Deciding what was Caesar's and what was God's proved to be very difficult indeed. My friends, I will confess to you that I don't know how to tell the difference between what belongs to Caesar and what belongs to God. Unlike both Caesar and Orville Redenbacher, God is notoriously averse to putting his face on stuff. Moses knew that. Even after a series of face-to-face meetings, within a matter of 9 short verses, Moses is no longer allowed to see the face of God. "You shall have no graven images" is number 2 on God's top 10 list of commandments. Of course, we do learn early in the Bible that God does stamp his image on things. Namely, God stamps his image on you and me. Meaning each of us is made in the image of God. Each of us bears the divine imprint. Each of us is marked out as belonging to God. Each of us bears God's brand. We belong, body and soul, to God. So I suppose that when we render unto God what is God's, we could give each other up. But I don't think that's what Jesus means. Frankly, I don't know what Jesus means. And I hate it when Jesus leaves it up to you and me to sort out this kind of thing. Life would be tons easier if Jesus would just come out with a straight answer and point to A, B, and C and say, these things are Caesar's. You can give them to him. D, E, and F, those are God's. Give them to God. But Jesus doesn't do that. Life doesn't come with labels. So we've got a problem on our hands. How to know what to give to Caesar and what to give to God. So I'm very grateful for Stanley Hauerwas, who says that to recognize that we have an insoluble problem is to begin to follow Jesus. Jesus' response to give to Caesar what is Caesar's and to give to God what is God's does create an insoluble problem. But that, says Hauerwas, is what it is meant to do. You know you have a problem, at least when you are a disciple of Jesus, when you do not have a problem. Any questions?